Welcome to Discovery 1, Module 5. Now, before I get started, does anybody have any questions up to this point? Anybody got any general questions that are pending and all that sort of stuff? Everybody enjoying the course so far?
Yep,
yes.
Especially with the notes you sent.
Yeah, the lectures are really good, and the notes, now that I know how to use the Qkit website really well, that really helps.
Jolly good.
Oh, and that makes all the difference. Then.
Yeah, we had students indeed. doing the course for 6 months, and we'd mentioned the QCAT site a couple of times, and they'd managed to miss it all the way through, and they were just going from the lectures.
There are lecture notes for the lectures? There are notes for each lecture, yep, up there. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if you haven't been to www.qcat.org yet, I'd be going there. Okay, we don't particularly want you guys setting it as your homepage. That might be a little bit sad, but kind of cool in a way. Now, anybody tell me, or type into their chat window if you're not in chat already, how many bits in an IP address, IPv4 address?
What were you asking, Kerry? I just got in the chat window.
How many bits in an IPv4 address? Hurrah! All right, there are 32 bits in an IPv4 address. Alrighty. Somebody's got an open mic. Thank you. Okay. Now, I think it would be fair to say that if you want to do, if you need to get on the internet and you want to do stuff on the internet, it is pretty fair to say that you need an IP address, okay? You need to have an IP address allocated to you so that you can communicate on the big, wide internet. Now, a lot of this lecture is going to be revision from last week, and in the one hand, I apologize from that, but in the other hand, it's going to be very useful for you guys to get some of the key prospects. Now, I would warn anybody who is the blinky multitasking type, we are going to be doing some binary calculations and stuff, so your multitasking ability may be impaired by having to think about the exercises that are being set. So this is fair warning. You can get back to your 7 Messenger windows, 2 Twitter accounts, and a partridge in a pear tree once we've finished our IP subnetting. These skills are crucial to working in the network field in any way, shape, or form. This is a base skill. It's all right, we haven't started the serious stuff yet. You can still have 7 Messenger windows, a Twitter, and a partridge in a pear tree. You'll be given fair warning when we actually start on the heavy stuff. That's all right, we know you all do it. That's okay, we don't have a problem with that. It's just make sure that this is the heavy stuff, so you may need to come back and listen to this stuff again after we've finished. This is the one where everybody usually hits the brick wall in discovery and starts panicking, so I'm really hoping to avoid that this time round. Okay, now, one of the other things that is worth pointing out is, generally speaking, on machines, you assign one IP address per interface. That is one IP address per interface. Can anybody tell me what an interface is defined as? Anybody know? Anyone want to have a guess?
One incoming source of your connection.
Yeah, it's partially one incoming source of the connection. Anybody else want to add something else?
How about a network interface, a network card? Couldn't that be what an interface is?
That's an example of an interface, yes. An interface is a device that can send and or receive network packets, or network traffic. So a network interface is a device that sends or receives network packets that has the ability to have an IP address assigned to it. Okay. Now, switches don't have interfaces. They have ports because, generally speaking, switches do not care about the IP addresses that are assigned. They care about the MAC addresses, so switches don't have interfaces, they have ports. Alright, so given that definition, if we have a standard, and this is slightly a trick question, if we have a standard integrated services router that has wireless, LAN, and the internet, how many interfaces are on it? Anybody else got any more answers? How many interfaces? No, I want you all to think about it a bit more. Okay, so it's got, it connects you to the internet. I'm going to re-ask the question, see if we get any different answers, if anybody wants to change their mind. Some of you have got it right. I'm not going to tell you who's got it right and who's got it wrong yet. It's got your wired ports, it's got wireless, and it's got a connection to the internet, and it's got all of your computers on the inside of it, and it's got the internet on the outside of it. How many interfaces has it got? And some of you have got the right answer.
I would say 2 or 3.
Anybody who said 2, you're absolutely correct. Somebody want to tell me what the 2 interfaces are? Like, generally, in general terms, what's on the 2 interfaces?
Yes, the network interface... network interface card, the NIC, and the router.
No, guys. The LAN and the wireless are not separate interfaces. This is why I'm trying to key this up. The LAN and the wireless are bridged together. They're actually separate ports, okay? So if you've got four LAN ports and you've got a wireless port, they are actually all connected together by a 5-port switch. Well done, Glenn. Internal and external addresses, or the LAN and the Ethernet. You've got the LAN and the internet. You've got an internet-facing interface, and you've got a LAN-facing interface. So you've got two interfaces. One is connected to the LAN, and the other is connected to the internet. Everybody with me on that? Or does anybody have any questions about that? A lot of people don't realize that when you've got an integrated services router that has wireless and it has 4 LAN ports and it connects to the internet, what you've actually got internally, generally speaking, in the device is you've got a 5-port switch. On 4 ports of the switch, you have your wired in PCs, and on the 5th port of the switch, you have the wireless access point, or it's bridged across to the wireless access point. All of those are tied together as one network interface.
So this would have 2 IP addresses, one dynamic and one static?
It can. I'm saying this is 90% of the time that this is what happens. Generally, the static IP address would be the management address of the router, and the dynamic address would generally be assigned by your internet service provider. That's generally how they're configured. Not all the time, but that's generally how they're done. And the NAT splits between the two. Oh, good. This is going to be a shorter lecture than I thought. No, it's not. I haven't started binary yet. Okay, so you have on your inside, you have non-routable IP addresses. Remember, a block of 10 dot addresses, or a block of 172.16 to 172.31 addresses, or a block of 192.168. dot something addresses on the inside. They are your internal network addresses. They are non-routable. They are not routed on the internet. You then have the router has a static IP address bound to it on the LAN. Can anybody tell me with that static address what portion of the IP configuration of the computer has that address into it? Which portion of the IP network setup has the router's static address put into it or assigned into it?
The LAN portion.
Nope.
The network server?
Not quite.
Default gateway?
Well done, the default gateway. Okay, so say for example you have Happy Lucky Dragon 764, and it has a static IP address of 192.168.1.1, and Jill's got a PC with 1.4, and Daniel's got a PC with 1.8, and Erica's got a PC with 1.27. All of the PCs will have 192.168.1.1 or the static IP address of the Happy Lucky Dragon 764 in the default gateway field. Can anybody tell me why? Let's ask a different question. Can anybody tell me what a default gateway is, or a gateway of last resort?
A default gateway is the address that's used to to get you onto the internet. It's used to connect you to the outside. It allows you to get outside of your local area network.
And it looks like Paul gets the cyber lollipop for today. No, that just happens to be the case, Armando. It is the address that lets you log into the router to change settings, but the default gateway is, how do I get off this network? How do I get out onto the internet? So say, for example, you've got this Happy Lucky Dragon 764. It's got an IP address of 192.168.1.1. If you open up the network properties and look at what the default gateway is. Now, if you're in Windows XP, the easiest way to do this, and I don't know how you do it in Windows 7, somebody can come up with Windows 7 instructions for me in a minute. Go to My Network Places, press Alt-Enter to open the properties of My Network Places. Then locate your network card, which will be Local Area Connection or Local Area Connection 26 if you've had a few shots with the drivers over the years, and press Enter. Once you get to the Status tab, press Control tab to get to the Support tab. Okay, I'll just give if anybody's got an XP machine in front of them that they can do that on, I'm just about to rip through and do that on mine, and I'll be able to tell you what shows up in here. And there is a details button. So if we hit spacebar on the details button, which is quite useful, I've got physical address, 192.168.100.132 is my IP address. Subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. Question, which class of network is that?
Class C.
You're supposed to be typing answers into chat, Paul, I'm afraid. Anybody else have an answer for me? 255.255.255.0, what class is that? Yep, class C. And I have a default gateway of 192.168.100.11, which is just happens to be how our network is set up. And the default gateway is where packets that need to go to the internet are sent, or any packets that are not destined for the local network. Alrighty, now, it is fair to say that you can get the same level of information from ipconfig/all. However, it is a little more time-consuming to dump that out onto text files or scroll through it to actually pull that information out. So, 192.168.1.1 is your default gateway. That happens to also be the management IP of the router, and that is where all of the packets... that is where all the packets go if they are destined to the internet. So, would it be fair to say that if you have an integrated services router on your network providing internet access, that the first hop of any trace route will be the integrated services router? True or false? Well done, guys. We might actually be teaching you bloke something.
That'd be the best.
Is it fair to say that if you have an integrated services router, I'm repeating it for Glenn, if you have an integrated services router on your network providing internet access, the first hop of any trace route should be the integrated services router? Alrighty. Anybody got any questions with that before I continue? Alright, so what I want everybody to do is before next week, because I realise we've got Easter coming up and all that sort of stuff, and if you don't celebrate Easter, whatever you're celebrating, and if you're not celebrating anything, then, I don't know, don't eat too much chocolate or something. I want you to have a look at your network configuration and find out what your default gateway is. You don't need to tell me what it is. I don't need to know, but, I mean, whatever. Basically, what will happen is I want you to find out what your default gateway is, and I want you to find out whether that is also the IP address of your router, if you can, by either connecting to it with a web browser or whatever. See if that is the first address based on your, if you do a traceroute. Alrighty. Now, network address, the IP address is 32 bits long. It's it is a 32-bit binary number. It's not very cool to specify IP addresses in binary numbers because you'd be saying lots of ones and zeros and it would become very confusing. However, if you remember from last week's lecture, an IP address is separated into two portions. Can anybody tell me what those, or type into chat what those two portions are? Anyone else want to have a shot at answering? Alright, we have network and host portion. Okay, network and host portion. On a Class C subnet, how many bits are available for the host portion? On a Class C, how many bits are available for the host portion? All over the place, like confused blindies at a blindie gathering. 8. There are 8 bits for the host portion. If I asked you how many bytes there were, would that have been an easier question? How many bytes are available in the host portion of a Class C? And the answer is 1. There is 1 byte for the host portion. Okay, we'll whip through this again. In Class A, there is 1 byte for the host portion. Sorry, 1 byte for the network portion. Get it right. 1 byte for the network portion. 3 bytes for the host portion. In Class B, there are 2 bytes for the network portion, 2 bytes for the host portion. In Class C, there are 3 bytes for the network portion, 1 byte for the host portion. Anybody having bells ringing there from last week's lecture? We went through the class distinctions. I'd also point out that the school kids over here are going on holidays for 2 weeks. You guys aren't. So we are having a lecture next week, and we're having a lecture a week after that, so we're just going to work all the way through. So lectures as usual next week. Okay, so if we look at Class C addresses, we have three bytes for the network portion and 1 byte for the host portion. I realise this all sorts of sounds a bit much, but you do need to remember how many bytes are for each portion. So if there are 4 bytes all up in a network portion, in an IP address, you've got to have 4 bytes all up. So for Class A, well, A is 1. If you're doing Braille, number sign A is Class A. Number sign 1 is Class A, so there's 1 byte for the network portion. Number sign B is the number 2. No, we're not doing Nemeth lower number stuff, okay? This is if we're writing the number sign. So the B is a Class B address, and that has 2 bytes in the network portion. Number sign C is 3 bytes. 3 bytes for the network portion and 1 byte for the host portion. Everybody cool on that? If you don't read Braille, I apologise in advance. I'm not going to start singing It's Easy as ABC, because I think we can all live without that. So ABC 1, 2, 3. That's a little song by the Jackson 5, and if you forget your network classes, that's how you can remember that one. Or at least they performed it, I'm sure. Yeah, okay, now, moving right along. So, in a Class B address, how many bytes for the host portion? Yay! Seriously, guys, you do just have to know this. And by the end of this course, you should just know this. So, Class A, 1 byte for the network portion. Class B, 2 bytes for the network portion. Class C, 3 bytes for the network portion. Which gives you 3 bytes for the host portion, 2 bytes for the host portion, and 1 byte for the host portion, respectively. Has Scott come down here yet, or is he still up in the main section? Oh, you say it like it's a bad thing. Just kidding. Alrighty, now, if I had 2 subnets, if I had a 192.168.1 subnet and a 192.168.2 subnet, which device could I use to connect those 2 subnets together? If I had 2 IP subnets, say for example they belong to accounting and admin, one of them was 192.168.1.0/24 and the next was 192.168.2.0/24, which device could I connect those networks together with? That is correct, a router. A router connects subnets together. So you can route from one subnet to another. Now it's interesting to note that a router only needs to know how to get to a specific subnet. It doesn't necessarily need to know how to get to the specific host on that subnet. It just concerns itself with getting to the particular subnet itself. So say for example we had 192.168.1.0 on interface 1, and 192.168.2.0 on interface 2, just to make it easy. If you were sending messages from the 192.168.1 subnet to the 192.168.1.2 subnet, you would route from interface 1 to interface 2 on the router. Everybody kind of cool with that?
Can you use 0 in an IP address anywhere?
I'll get to that in a minute. If the 0 is part of the host portion, it causes it to be treated as the network address. Okie dokie. Now, I think we remember saying last week that the subnet mask shows us which bits belong to the network portion and which bits belong to the host portion. Everybody remember that bit? Alrighty. Now, and as we noticed, the subnet mask has all ones on the left-hand side and all zeros on the right-hand side. And the number of ones on the left-hand side say how many bits are part of the network portion, and the number of zeros on the right show how many bits are part of the host portion. Okay, that doesn't necessarily have to drop on a class boundary. So you can have subnet masks that say there are 6 bits available for hosts and there are 26 bits available for network. Okay. Now, this curriculum apparently does let you convert from decimal to binary, with the Windows calculator and vice versa, but I'm going to briefly cover the process of converting from decimal to binary.
It's much easier to do it yourself than do it with the Windows calculator, actually.
I've never tried it. Anybody else other than Grace tried it with the Windows calculator? I do it with BC under Linux. I go IBase equals 2, OBase equals 10, and key in a binary number, and it does it for me. Or I go IBase equals 10, OBase equals 2, and I key in a decimal number, and it converts it to binary. Not all of you have probably have. Although, Rose, see if BC exists on the Mac, in the terminal. If you can go into BC on the Mac, you should have it by default, I think.
All right.
When you get to it.
All right, what am I typing in?
BC. Bravo, Charlie.
BC 1.06, copyright, la 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 la.
All right, just go IBASE equals 2, as in I, and then the word base equals 2, and it should tell you nothing.
Yeah, it told me. It said new I.
Yeah, and then go OBase equals 10.
Uh-huh.
Now put 8 ones and hit enter.
It said 11111 at me.
Did it give you the conversion?
It just repeated back at me 111.
Okay, I'll just have a tamper here because I've managed to get these to behave. So I'll have to look into that, but it should have converted it to decimal for you. And you should have got 255, but I'll just have to figure out why that didn't work. Okie dokie. Okay, that's broken. I've got to look into that. I did have it working once upon a time, but you can actually get that to convert it for you. Otherwise, if you have Windows Calculator, we wish you the best of luck in figuring out how to use that. It's a bit tricky with JAWS. It is usable, but I have found it a little bit quirky. It does work, but it's not the nicest interface.
Is the 7 calculator broken in JAWS? Because I tried to do something with it and it just said equals control not visible.
No, you probably might need to maximize it, or you might need to do something. I've seen that happen in, XP as well.
Okay.
Okay, now here's the heavy bit. If we are converting a number from binary to decimal or decimal to binary, now we all know in binary that we have two possible digits. We have 0 and 1. These are the two states of the bits, or off and on. Everyone cool with that bit? Okie dokie. Now, if we look at how our number system works, and I'm going to quickly go over this. If we're looking at the base 10 number system, we have the numbers from 0 to 9. Everybody happy with that? Hopefully you are. If you're not, then I'm sorry, there's probably a problem. Then once we get up to 9, we have 10, which is 1 lot of 10 plus 0 lots of 1. If we go to 11, we have one lot of 10 plus one lot of 1. If we go to 12, we have one lot of 10 plus two lots of 1. Everybody cool with that? I have memories of Cuisenaire rods every time I go through this. Alrighty. Now, the other thing you can do is, now, it's also possible to say that in the base 10 number system, we can express everything as 10 to the power of something if we are talking about whole numbers, okay? So, if we want to look at 10, the number 10, 10 is 10 to the power of 1. Everybody happy with that?
Sorry, say that again?
10 to the power of 1 is 10.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can anybody tell me what 10 to the power of 0 is?
0, I believe. No, sorry.
The correct answer is 1. Anything raised to the power of 0 equals 1. Anything to the power of 0 equals 1. Except for 0. Anything except 0 to the power of 0. Yeah. Anything except for 0 to the power of 0 is 1. Why? Well, I can actually prove that to you, but it is a little bit of a mathematical proof. If we have, let me think of my example. Okay, if we have, I don't know whether people are aware of this, but if you have something raised to the same power, you can actually multiply and divide numbers together by adding and subtracting the indices. Those of you who are old enough to do log tables would know all about this. Those of you who are a bit younger might not have had anything to do with a log table, so we are sort of being a little bit advanced in the maths here. But if we have 10 to the power of 3, can anybody tell me what 10 to the power of 3 is?
1,000.
That's correct. Does anybody know, for those of you who don't know how to calculate 10 to the power of 3, it is 10 times 10 times 10. 10 times 10 is 100, times 10 is 1,000. Alright, so if we have 10 to the power of 3, which is 1,000, and we have 10 to the power of 3 divided by 10 to the power of 3, we actually then take the indexes and say 3 minus 3 is 0, because if we're dividing, we subtract the indices, and 1,000 divided by 1,000 is 1, therefore 10 to the power of 0 is 1. There's your mathematical proof for that. You could just take my word for it that 10 to the power of 0 is 1, and 2 to the power of 0 is 1, and 27 to the power of 0 is 1. That might be simpler. Any questions so far? All right. So, do you think it would be fair to say that if anything to the power of 0 happened to equal 1, that we could express the number 5 as 5 times 10 to the power of 0? Does that sound cool?
It sounds needlessly complex, but workable.
Well, say, for example, you've got the number 123, okay? You have 3 lots of 10 to the power of 0, plus 2 lots of 10 to the power of 1, plus 3 lots of 10 to the power of 2. That's how our number system works. So, I may have actually got those around the wrong way, but the 100 is 1 times 10 to the power of 2, the 20 is 2 times 10 to the power of 1, and the 3 is 3 times 10 to the power of 0. You're going to think, well, why would I even bother with that? But this is how our number system works, and when I get into binary, it's going to become very important. Alright, now, in binary, we have two possible digits. We have 0 and 1. And all of our powers of 2 are what we use to do the binary conversion. So, say for example, we have all the powers of 2. 2 to the power of 0 is 1. And you can write yourself out a table of these later. Or find a table in your notes somewhere. 2 to the power of 0 is 1. 2 to the power of 1 is 2. 2 to the power of 2 is 4. 2 to the power of 3 is 8. 2 to the power of 4 is 16. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Anybody tell me what's happening to the numbers each time I raise the power?
They double.
And if you know the inchworm song, you'll be able to know all of the powers up to 32. I don't know if the inchworm is just an Australian thing, but there was a song about the inchworm. And it sings about 1 and 1 is 2, 2 and 2 is 4, etc. Anybody heard the Inchworm song, or am I alone with this one?
Yeah, I need to perform.
Four and four.
I wonder if Schoolhouse Rock ever did a song about a component.
Yeah, we get to sing the Inchworm song. We do that each time we go through the binary. Okay. So in binary, you can either have a 1 or you can have a 0. And depending on where those 1s and 0s are, depends on how much they are worth. Alright? So, if we are counting in binary, and yes, some of us are bored enough to actually do this, you start off at 0, which is pretty good. Then you have 1, which is the number 1. The next number you have in binary is 10. That is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1 plus 0. You then have 11, which is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1 plus 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0. In other words, 2 plus 1 equals 3. See what I mean about this is where it gets a bit complicated? Okay. If you then want to go 11, you can then go 100, which is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 2, which is 4, plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 1 plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 0. So 100 is 4 in binary. Jolly good. Now, when we are dealing with IP addresses, usually the maximum quantity we are converting from binary to decimal is going to be an 8-bit quantity. So the maximum numbers we are going to deal with is 255. Okay? So if you're converting 8-bit quantities, then the maximum number you're going to convert is 255. Now, there are various methods of doing these conversions. It depends which way. I think we might go from decimal to binary first. That's probably the best way to do it. Now, this is the way I do it. And be aware that you may have to go back and listen to the recording again at a later date. We've got pegboards, so that makes it a lot easier for us. And if you talk to Grace, she's kind of in love with her pegboard as much as you're ever in love with a pegboard. It's great. You put the pegs down.
Pegboards are amazing.
And anybody who wants a pegboard, there are diagrams of the pegboard up on the QCAT website under general instructions. You may be able to get somebody who's good with a drill and some bits of dowel to make you one up. They are too expensive to ship over anywhere. Basically, the pegboard has 3 rows of 32 holes drilled in a piece of plyboard, and between each 8 rows of holes there is a vertical line to separate it on byte boundaries, and you put pegs in where you want 1s and you pull pegs out where you want 0s. The other way to do it is to use your fingers on your keyboard and place all 8 fingers down if you want all 8 bits set to 1, or lift the fingers up if you want the bits set to 0, or if you want to do it the other way around, that's another way of doing it. It's a bit tricky, but it will let you keep track of which bits are set and which bits are not set. Okay, so all whole numbers can be expressed as an addition of powers of 2. So say, for example, we are converting the number 21 into binary. Okay, what we do is we find the biggest power of 2 that is going to be subtractable from 21. So the biggest power of 2 that is subtractable from 21 is 16, 2 to the power of 4. So we write a 1 down. So 2 to the power of 4 is 16, 21 minus 16 is 5, so we put a 1 down. The next power of 2, can anybody tell me what the next power of 2 down from 16 is? It is 8. Can 8 be subtracted from 5 without going negative? Then put a 0. So we've got 10. Okay? The next power of 2 that we have down from 8 is 4. Can we subtract 4 from 5? Yes, we can. Put a 1 down. So we've got 101. Okie dokies. Can we subtract can we subtract 2 from 1? No, we can't. So we end up with a 0. Can we subtract 1 from 1? Yes, we can, so we put a 1 down. So we end up with 101001, I think. Depends if anybody was writing the bits and pieces down there. But we have a bit set for 16, we have a bit set for 4, and we have a bit set for 1. You are allowed to use Windows Calculator to do the addition of the powers of 2. And we encourage you to use, because a lot of people aren't very good at addition. I'm aware that not everybody's math skills are the best. So you can actually, if once you've got the powers of 2 that you need to add up, you can actually use your calculator to add up the powers of 2. If you're lucky enough to have like the Clockulator or one of the Sharp calculators, they're really good for this. You can add all your powers of 2 up. Okay, any questions on that so far? Any Windows calculator would be fine. Okay, anybody got any questions on any of that? Because I've covered a lot of stuff that you guys probably haven't seen before. Anybody a bit confused? It's okay to own up. You're allowed to be confused at this point.
That's good.
All right. Sorry?
Can you have fractions?
Oh,
sorry,
yes.
Can
sorry,
you have fractions? So you'd have 10.01.
You don't write it like that, and in fact, what you do is you use what's called a floating point. And believe me, you don't want to know. Basically, you express the... you can have fractions, you certainly can, otherwise calculators wouldn't work. But how you actually express those fractions in a binary form is quite tricky. If I remember correctly, 2 to the power of minus 1 is a half? I'd have to actually look that up. But yes, you certainly can do fractions. We don't deal with fractions. Okay, so if you are converting a number from binary into decimal, okay, work from the right, looking at all of the digits that are in front of you, write down the powers of 2 that you need to add together, and then add them all together. So say, for example, we have the binary number 1010, okay? We're working from the right, so our right-handmost digit is 0. We don't need anything there. We move a digit to the left, 1. So we're adding 2 to the power of 1, so we have 2 plus. Then we move to the left again, 0, we don't add anything. Move to the left again, 2 to the power of 3 is 8, so we add 1, so 8 and 1 is 9, so 1010 is 9 in decimal.
Where do you get the 3? I guess that's where I'm hung up on.
What, the 2 to the power of 3?
Yeah, like how do you know that it's a 3?
Because from the right, it's 2 to the power of 0, then to the left, 2 to the power of 1, then to the left, 2 to the power of 2, then to the left, 2 to the power of 3. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, as you work from right to left. Which is an interesting story. We had a table of powers of 2 that, back when we first started, that Ian had formatted up. And it was written out in the sighted way of writing tables, which means it wasn't turned sideways and bashed about a bit with a stick. And basically, when I read down the table, Jaws said, 2 to the power of 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 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, 1, 28, 64, 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1, 0.
Not confusing at all.
Yeah, there you go. So everybody get that? Good, there'll be a test on that. No, just kidding. I may actually be typing up some exercises for you guys to do. I think there's actually some labs where you need to do conversions in Chapter 5. I'm having memories of those labs. Now, I think they let you do the conversions with the Windows calculator. It's up to you whether you use the Windows calculator or not, but I can assure you that when you get into the networking and stuff, the binary will become important. I'm not going to dwell on that too much further because I think we've done enough binarying for one day. I'm not going to dwell deliberately on the conversion process. We will cover it again and we will go over it again. But I'm going to talk about some properties of IP addresses that I covered last week, which are important. And we will talk about those now. Okay. Anybody got any questions on any of that before I continue on? Yeah, who's got questions? Yes, no? Is that yes, you've got a question and no, you don't want to ask it? Or no, you've got a question and yes, you're going to ask it? Or are you just, was there a yes already into chat and I didn't know about the yes that was already in chat? Alrighty. Now, remember how we said yesterday that the subnet mask told you how many bits were part of the network portion and how many bits were part of the host portion? and the bits that were part of the network portion go on the left-hand side, and the bits that go on the host portion go on the right-hand side. And we said that if there was 3 bytes in the network portion and 1 byte in the host portion, there would be 24 bits in the network portion and 8 bits in the host portion. Everyone happy with that? Okie dokies. Now, and does anybody remember that I told you that if all of the host bits were set to 0, that was the network address of the network, so 192.168.1.0 is the network address of the 192.168 network, all of the host bits are set to 0. And if all of the host bits are set to 1, this is the broadcast address, which would be 192.168.1.255. So that would mean that all of the host bits are set to 1. Given that information, that we have a network address and we have a host address, how many available IP addresses are on a Class C network? Anybody having trouble working this out? If we have 0 to 255, we have 256 possible combinations. If 2 of them are used by network and broadcast address, 256 minus 2 is 254. Any questions on that?
Hey, in English you have creative writing. Can we have creative maths?
Yeah. Well, this is the only math module in the whole course, so...
Try doing it in base 4, that'd be creative.
Yeah. This is the only math module in the whole thing, and we do have to tell people that there is math in Discovery, and they usually like panic and run the other way, but this is the only math module, and then we do the subnetting stuff through the other three, Discovery 2, 3, and 4, and it's sort of one of those things that you can't really avoid the subnetting and be a decent network engineer. The problem being that if you make a mess with a subnet calculator, you'll have no way of cross-checking your results. Also, you are not permitted a subnet calculator in the Cisco exam, and in fact what you are allowed to have is somebody who will write things onto a bit of paper for you so that you can work out what you need to work out to convert these decimals to binaries. Okay. Now, and I also said last week that if you wanted to know how many hosts you could have on a TCP/IP address, TCP/IP subnet, it was 2 to the power of H minus 2, where H is the number of host bits, which is 2 caret H minus 2, just because Jaws decided not to read the carats out for me, or eSpeak decided not to read the carats out for me. So in our example above, if there were 8 bits in the host portion, 2 to the power of 8 is 256, 2 to the power of 8 is 256, and 256 minus 2 is 254, which is how many hosts we can have on our subnet.
Which ports are the reserved ones?
As I told you, if all of the host bits are set to 0, then that is the network address, and if all of the host bits are set to 1, it's the broadcast address. The reason I say that is because if it's not done on a bit boundary, say for example we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.192, it means that your network address is 0 and your broadcast address is 63, which is why I say it has to be all of the host bits set to 0 or all of the host bits set to 1.
Okay,
so that means a Class A address can have about a billion hosts.
No. 2 to the power of 24 is 16.7 million.
I was apparently learned this wrong, but I was under the impression that a subnet could only be... a byte in a subnet could only be 255 or 0, so apparently I'm wrong there.
If you are using class-based addressing, as in Class A, B, and C, that is true. But if you are using what we call CIDR, or classless inter-domain routing, which is how the internet works now, you can be allocated blocks of addresses which are smaller than a Class C. And if you are, say, allocated 64 addresses, your network address for the first 64 subnet will be 0, the broadcast will be 63, the network for the next subnet will be 64, the broadcast will be 127, 128, 191, 192, 223, Hang on. No, 128 to 191. Yeah, that's right. And then 192 and 255. So it's all of the host bits set to 0 or 1. So it's not just 255 and 0. You guys are not expected to do classless interdomain routing in Discovery 1. You're just concerned with the class A, B, and C ones. So it'll be the number of bytes. They're generally divisible on a byte boundary. Okay, now what actually happens inside a router, and I will cover this in the in this lecture because it's covered in the notes. What happens is the router takes the IP address, it compares it with the subnet mask. Well, it actually does a logical AND, and it actually checks the destination address with the subnet mask against its routing table. And if it matches the subnet mask or one of the routers, the networks that it knows how to send to, the router then forwards that packet to that particular network. So on your home router, you're likely to have an internal route from 192.168.1.0 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0 is destined to the LAN and the wireless. And the router knows that if it sees packets destined to 192.168.1.0, /24 or with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, it sends it to the LAN and the wireless section. Anyone got any questions on that? I have a feeling that the majority of you are a little confused. Alrighty. If it's any consolation, the lectures don't tend to get harder than this one, so it's sort of easier for the rest of the chapters after this one. Alright, the other thing I need to go over again is network address translation, and it is covered in this module as well. If you have an integrated services router and it performs network translation, it is responsible for translating the internal non-routable IP addresses so that they can be used on the external internet. So you have one internet-facing IP address and all of your other machines are hidden behind that internet-facing IP address. And the network address translator is responsible for converting the internal addresses when the packets go from the internal network to the Ethernet, and actually rewrites the IP address and usually the ports as well, the source port anyway, so that it has the external network address of the internet interface. And when the packets come back to the router, it then reverses that process because it knows which packets it sent out, therefore it can send the return packets back to the hosts that are on the internal network. Okay, anybody got any questions? Any questions on all of Module 5? Does anybody at this point need any clarification on the binary decimal conversions or any of the subnet stuff, or is there anything that I could clarify?
At this point, I'm not even sure what I don't know.
Yeah, that's pretty standard. Subnet, what do you need me to clarify on subnets? Okay, I'll answer Jonathan's question while we're waiting. The reason it is called a subnet mask is because the actual binary number is logically ANDed with the IP address that you're looking at, and what the mask actually does is it turns off all of the bits that are host bits, like 255.255.255.0. When you AND it with the subnet mask, it turns off all of the host bits on the right-hand side of the address. Therefore, the subnet mask only lets the network bits through, so it just shows you the network portion of the address, not the host portion. I'm not supposed to cover logical operations in this lesson, but suffice it to say that a logical AND, if you picture a pipe that has two taps in it, and it has a water source at one end and it has the other end of the garden hose at the other, an AND gate is two taps in one pipe. For the output to be one, both taps must be open. Therefore, 1 and 1 is 1, 1 and 0 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 0 and 0 is 0, so the only time you'll get a 1 is if both of the inputs are 1 on an AND gate, but I don't actually cover that in this course. Okay. Did you end up thinking up your question, Glenn, or are the... Okay, the cogs are still spinning. That's all right. If anybody has any questions, we can certainly post them to the mailing list. We are also available on Skype, or you can email us directly to ask the questions. I will probably write up a couple of exercises for...
I might have the old ones, actually, if you want them, Carrie.
Oh, we can always send those through.
Might is the word, but I'm pretty sure
I've got them if you don't. They're in the list archives from last year. Okay, the other thing I need to cover is DHCP, and this will be the end of this module once I've covered DHCP. DHCP stands for Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. It actually stands for Dynamic Host Control Protocol. It's not actually Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, but a lot of people write configuration instead of control. It's actually Dynamic Host Control Protocol. When a machine comes onto a new network for the first time and you have the radio button set for assign IP address automatically, assign DNS server automatically, the machine comes onto the network and it sends out a discover packet, which is actually sent to the non-network specific broadcast address, which is 255.255.255.255, and the MAC address that the packet is sent to is ff:ff:ff:ff:ff:ff, which is the broadcast MAC address. And it says, I am this MAC address, what are you going to give me? And the DHCP service says, I'm going to offer you 192.168.1.4, a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, DNS server of 192.168.1.1, default gateway of 192.168.1.1. The PC then requests, I would like 192.168.1.4 and all the other stuff I just said. And then once that has happened, the DHCP server acknowledges that request and it makes an entry in its lease database that says, I have leased 192.168.1.4 to the PC with MAC address, blah, 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 and I have leased that for a day or 8 hours or 3 hours or whatever. Has everybody ever seen the commands ipconfig/release and ipconfig/renew?
Can you not do those in 7 anymore?
Yes, you can. You've got to do them as administrator.
Ah. How do you log into administrator from the command?
You right-click on the command prompt icon say launch as administrator.
Because I'm used to running CMD from the run box, which obviously wouldn't work. Okay.
There is a hack that will allow all command prompts to be administrative access, but I'm not quite sure what it is. Yes, you can have leases longer than a day. You can actually have leases. I think the quantity that stores the lease length is a 32-bit unsigned integer, therefore you can have leases up to 4 billion seconds long.
How long is 4 billion seconds? That's a good question.
You can work that out if you divide 4,294,635,482 by 86,400. That will tell you how many days it is.
I'll get right up.
46,000 days, roughly. Yep, 46,296 days is 4 billion seconds. Okay,
now what's
so
the...
that end...
So, what's the use of releasing or renewing IP addresses on a daily basis when you're just on a small local network?
There can be times when you reconfigure the DHCP server and your machine has an old lease and you've brought it out of standby and it hasn't picked up the correct information, therefore you want to release and renew the lease that you were supposed to have. Or if you're using a cable modem and the ISP has sort of crashed and come back up and your cable modem has an old lease, you can release the IP address and renew it to get a different one that will actually be routable and will actually get stuff to work again.
Well, why the lease time, I guess, is my question.
The reason that Dynamic Host Control Protocol has a least time is because sometimes you have a population of hosts that's bigger than the number of IP addresses you have to allocate. So say, for example, you've got 40 hosts, but you've only got 32 IP addresses to allocate, but not everybody is in at work at the same time. You can actually have people allocating their IP addresses when they come into work, and they're leased for a certain amount of time, and then those addresses are reallocated to other computers when those people go home and the leases expire or the leases haven't been renewed by those computers. So say, for example, you've got a coffee shop. You might have a lot of people coming through the coffee shop with their laptops, or you've taken all your laptops to Starbucks. You don't need an IP address, an internal IP address, for everybody that is ever going to visit Starbucks. You only need enough IP addresses for the number of people that are going to surf the internet on the wireless hotspot at any particular point in time.
So is there any purpose to it for people that are just on a home router and only have like 3 or 4 devices or computers that they connect at any given time?
Yes. How many errors have you ever made typing into a network dialog box? Well, not you personally, but people generally. If you key in the wrong information, it won't work. And it becomes quite a drag to go around to 4 or 5 computers and key in the IP address, the subnet mask, the default gateway, and the 2 name servers into every IP configuration box.
No, I like the HCP. I'm just talking about the lease timeout specifically.
You always have a lease timeout. You always have a lease timeout as a safety, because if you turn off your average integrated services router, it's going to forget every lease it ever assigned. And when you bring the machines back online and they try to reacquire their IP addresses, they won't be able to, because they won't have the same IP addresses as they did last time, so they'll have to actually reacquire their IP addresses. It is also possible on some home routers to actually go into a certain section and do what we call an IP address reservation, which is where you put the MAC address of the PC and you put in an IP address that you want to reserve for that particular PC, so that whenever that PC comes online, it will be assigned that IP address. Can anybody think of a reason where you'd want to assign a static IP address to a PC? There's a couple of them.
One that comes to mind for me is if you're afraid of UPnP and want to port forward and stuff.
Map network drives, no, I disagree. I'd be getting name resolution working, honestly. I'd get NetBIOS name resolution. You shouldn't really be mapping to /192.168.1.7/share name. There's probably something terribly broken with your NetBIOS resolution if you're doing that. But you can do it that way. The other reason you do it, yeah, if you don't trust UPnP and you want to do port forwarding, or, as far as I recollect, in the older implementations of UPnP, they could only forward TCP ports. They can't forward UDP ports with UPnP, which means that if you are using MuTorrent, which of course none of you would be, if you don't forward the UDP port that is the same as the torrent port, you will not get any DHT traffic, and it will take you 24 hours to 3 days to find any of the peers in the swarm in the absence of the tracker working. And believe me, the trackers break more often than you think. So you want the TCP and the UDP port mapped through the network. The other thing to remember is that if you are running Skype, which a lot of people are, Skype listens on a particular port, say for example 31804. If you forward the TCP port 31804 through to your internal machine, both the TCP and UDP ports, Skype can then make a direct connection from source to target, which will cause two things to happen. It will allow you to log in about a half a second rather than waiting the 3 to 5 seconds that it usually takes, and it will greatly cut down on your call dropouts and things, which happens if you're relaying through a supernode. It will also reduce your call latency, and it will make file transfers much faster because you are transferring directly from PC to PC, not through a supernode.
And supernodes are basically other Skype users.
Supernodes are other Skype users, but guess what? If you didn't have any supernodes, the whole Skype network would fall over and you wouldn't be able to call anyone. You'd never get out from behind a network address translator. And that's what the supernodes are for. They're responsible for relaying traffic between two machines that are behind network address translators so that you can talk on Skype. In fact, if every machine that was acting as a supernode turned off the ability to be a supernode and blocked all of the incoming connections, the Skype network would fail to function. Scary, huh?
Do you know if you're a supernode?
If you have a forwarded port and you have both the ports forwarded, you don't always know that you're a supernode. You can, however, sometimes see the spikes in traffic. There is a registry hack that will turn off supernode functionality, which is important if you're in Australia and you're on very strict bandwidth caps. If you don't have your ports forwarded, you will not be acting as a supernode. However, you will experience higher call latency and you have a much higher possibility of having your Skype calls drop out on you at random times. So that's the price you pay for not forwarding it. Alrighty. Anybody got anything else that they want to talk about before we hit the stop button? That's all of the prepared material I have today. I think it would be a good idea if anybody happened to have any questions by next week's lecture that they bring them with them, because I would like to see, or email them to the discuss list. This is a complex module and it does take a while to get this binary stuff down pat. How do you know if a port is forwarded or not? You actually run netstat dash capital B from the command line of Windows, and if you see connections from your IP address and your source port that Skype is listening on, which you looked up earlier, to a destination host, you can tell that your port has been forwarded.
How well do we have to understand and remember the layers?
The layers? The OSI reference layers?
Yeah, and I believe there's some ones to do with TCP as well.
I haven't seen those come up in the lecture notes yet, to my knowledge, unless I've missed something. I thought the layered models didn't come in until chapter 6 or 7.
I think they started them in 5, possibly.
You mentioned them about 3 weeks ago.
Only in passing, but I think we actually go through more of the OSI reference model later on in the module. You will need to know all of the 7 OSI reference layers, but it hasn't really been covered in the chapters up to this point, so I've only glossed over it. So yes, we will be going over please do not throw sausage pizza away, physical data link network transport presentation session application, or all people seem to need data processing if you want to go the other way, and I will be going through the TCP/IP reference model, but that happens later on in the modules.
Oh, because you mentioned them in passing, I thought there was something I was supposed to understand and everybody else did, but okay, thanks.
No, we will be covering them in greater detail later in the modules.
Carrie, by the way, is it a requirement to be on the discuss list as well as the announce list?
Okay, anything else?
No, but you'll
miss out on a lot of very good information if you're not on the discuss list.
I happened not to be.
I thought I signed you up for it.
No, actually all I got was the announce list. I've been getting the announce emails, but not the discuss.
You can check that in the web
interface.
That can
be fixed if you want it to be.
What did you say?
It can be fixed if you want it to be.
I do want it to be fixed, so
I don't miss out
on any information. Thank you.
You can read what was on the discuss lists by visiting the list archives, which are referred to at the bottom of every announce post, and you just replace the word announce with discuss, and that will allow you to read all of the messages that were previously posted to the discuss list. And believe me, it gets busy from time to time, as people have found out.
Okay, thank you, Carrie.
All right, everyone, that's all we have in the prepared lecture for today. If you have any questions, post them to the mailing list, call us on Skype, email us, enjoy whatever you're celebrating. If you're not celebrating anything, then have a good week anyway. And we will be around on Skype for the next... we'll be around on Skype for quite a number of hours. There is Grace's ITE 1 lecture tomorrow. Anybody who's attending that one, please try and be there for that one. And we will hopefully see you all next week if you don't talk to us on Skype beforehand regarding any...
Sorry. Mm? I just have a question for people in my ITE1 class. Are there any other people who are going to have conflicts tomorrow night? Because if so, maybe we'll just do some kind of a review and do questions and shortened lecture. But if everybody's going to be okay, then we'll go into Module 6 because I don't want to get in the way of people who are traveling because I know tomorrow's like a travel night and all that.
Isn't it only Wednesday night, though?
Oh, you're right. Never mind. It's Thursday for us. You guys have a lecture tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what I thought.